Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Kernels. I'm Christopher Hooton. I'm here at the Independent offices in London, and this is episode 4. We've had actors up until now on the podcast, but this is our first week with the director, and quite a fitting one too, because, you know, this is a British podcast and it's with a British director who's an exciting creator and very much on the rise at the moment. It's Ben Wheatley. You might know him for his kind of ambient horrors set in the English countryside that he tends to do, like Sightseers, A Field in England. But then with the last couple of films, he's really managed to kind of ensnare a big budget and really kind of go for it in terms of the kind of cinematic things he can create. So, you know, when he was making films not so long ago, in 2009, he made a film for like $6,000, and now he's just made one for over $5 million. So it's incredible that, you know, to take on that and to go through that rise in such a brief period of time, and it must be a lot of challenges involved, and that's kind of what we try and get down to a little bit, really. He did High Rise last year, which is one of my favourite films of the year, actually, but for whatever reason it got a bit forgotten about, I think. One of those ones where it came out really early in the year, and then by the time it got to awards season, no one really remembered it. But a really, really great film, and really opulent and just full of loads of amazing kaleidoscopic shots and stuff, but still quite arty. Whereas his new film, Free Fire, which you may have seen, it's all on billboards right now, is just a much more kind of commercial, mainstream, accessible film. But not in a bad way. I don't begrudge him that. It's exciting to get him to see him doing something a bit more different and more of a straight up action film. So if you don't know, essentially the premise of the film is very simple. It's just about a gang of criminals who go to a warehouse to meet up with a group of arms dealers and do what should be a very simple trade of money for rifles, except things start to go south and then go further south and just generally turn into everything turns into a massive gunfight. And it's basically a single, well, it is a single location piece, which I always enjoy, like, and kind of regardless of quality, you know. I'll fuck with Phone Booth. Like, there's something about those films I really like. I think maybe it's just kind of the most pure escapism in a way, because you're really, for those 2 hours, you're just going to this one location that's usually pretty bizarre or far away from where you are in your life or in the world, and just staying there and existing with those same characters in that same place. So I always quite enjoy them, and Free Fire's a cool little movie. Cillian Murphy's in it. Armie Hammer, who I always enjoy, Brie Larson, who I think signed up for the film before she did Room, so she was kind of a sort of a nobody when they signed her, and then now she's an Oscar winner, so they got lucky with that one. But yeah, it's a cool movie. It's kind of like, well, very much like a Tarantino thing, really. It reminded me of Reservoir Dogs, maybe not quite as dialogue heavy as if Tarantino had done it. I mean, there's a lot of gunfire in this film. It is accurately named. I think they got through thousands and thousands of shells of ammunition. So yeah, I caught up with Ben. He was in the penthouse suite of a Mayfair hotel, which was pretty bizarre. Essentially, at the moment, a lot of these interviews I'm doing kind of like on the road, you know, until I'm Marc Maron level and I can do an interview in my garage or a fucking canoe or something, unfortunately, and they come to me. At the moment, I'm going out to them to meet these people. So we were set up there, which was funny for two reasons, really, because it was such a grand, opulent kind of hotel room that it reminded me of High Rise, bizarrely. But also just because Ben's not a guy that doesn't seem to be very into that sort of stuff, you know. You feel like you should be meeting him in a fish and chip shop, really. He's quite a grounded man. But yeah, he was just set up there, had his shoes off, his legs up. He just slouched on the sofa, just like watched about a million films. It's very comfortable, and we just, yeah, chatted a bit about the process really that goes into making a film like Free Fire and what it's like to do with all that money to suddenly find yourself with 5 million to play with rather than 6 grand. So, yeah, I hope you enjoy. I hope you enjoy our chat. And next week on the podcast, my colleague's going to be interviewing, I'm going to murder this pronunciation, I can only apologise, Julia Ducournau, the director of the French-Belgian horror Raw that's getting a lot of buzz at the moment. It was described very memorably as a beautifully realised, symbolically rich and disturbingly erotic meditation on primal hungers. So I'm looking forward to seeing that one. All right, I hope you enjoy our chat. So hi Ben, how you doing?
I'm good, thanks.
Are you busy at the moment, or are you like got between productions a little bit of time?
Well, no, it's all the stuff for Free Fire at the moment. So I've just come back from Austin.
Oh right, yeah.
Where they screened it there 2 days ago, and I got in this morning, and then got loads of press for Free Fire, and then I'm partway through this 26-date tour up and down the country of doing Q&As and stuff.
Right, like yeah. Yeah, I caught Free Fire last night. Congrats. It's really cool.
Oh, cool.
I've always been fond of single location kind of films.
Yeah, it's like, you know, another riff on Dinner with Andre.
Yeah. I was watching it thinking, like, I can't really imagine what the script looked like for this because it's so kind of action cue led.
Yeah, I mean, it's just lots of description.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it a bit of a nightmare to keep on top of when you were shooting, like, in terms of the kind of supervision and making sure you had coverage for everything?
No, I was editing as I shot it, so I had this system set up that would take the pictures straight from the cameras into an edit suite. So I would kind of do a bit of directing, and watch what we were shooting on the monitors, and as it came through, then just chop it into the film.
Yeah.
And so that way you can't really go too wrong.
I was reading in the production notes that you said that you enjoy editing. And I make a few films myself, and I always really enjoy the process, even though I think a lot of people don't. But why do you enjoy the editing?
Why do people not?
What do yeah, because it's the crux of it, right?
Yeah, well, it's one of the unique things that cinema has over the novel or,
yeah,
you know, theatre, is that you can bend time. So, yeah, I've always loved that. And I like the physicalness of it, that you can just take a chunk of something and then put it next to another chunk of something, and then it has a totally different meaning, and then you put something else, a third piece on, and then it all means something else again, and then you take it all apart and then put them together in a different order and it means something else again. So it's kind of, yeah, it is the boiler room of a film.
How do you like to edit? What's your setup, and do you have are you quite ritualistic about it or not really?
No, I mean, I generally for Free Fire it was in a little room in our house, running on just a standard kind of off the peg Mac, and basically when Amy and I edit, Amy Jump, who's the co-writer and co-editor on this, I operate the machine and she sits next to me and tells me what to do.
Yeah,
that's how it works.
Was there anything that kind of, any moments of anxiety on this, on with the production things that were challenging, or was it fairly smooth, would you say? Because it was a different kind of film.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. There's no great story to the making of it. I mean, it was usually the anxiety comes in the financing and the putting together of the film, and that, you know, that's usually unusually stressful. I wrote a diary, I think, around the period, just because I couldn't believe what was going on, you know, for about 6 months, and I reread it the other day, and it just gave me the fear just going through it, like, you know, how many things were happening each day,
yeah,
and the pressure of it all. But it, you know, once it's sorted, you just don't think about it again.
Do you generally find that like pre-production can be more stressful, where actually when you're in it you're kind of more in the zone on set, and that's not so much the stressful part?
No, that's the treat. The making of the thing is a treat, and the editing is slightly stressful because you start to see the shape of what you've made and that you're going to be responsible for, and then you've got all the anxiety up until the release. But the actual shooting bit is the, you know, in my experience anyway, it's been the fun bit.
Mm. And then, because it was all based in like one warehouse in Brighton, right?
Mm.
So you were you guys all
you know, staying around the set and around there a lot of the time together? Or
well, it was in the summer. It was really nice. So they, all the actors had apartments, and loads of crew were living there as well.
Yeah.
And I live around the corner from where we were shooting. So yeah, it was great. And
does that make a difference, you think, or is that a myth? You know, the idea that when everyone's kind of in this one location together, that there's, it feels like more of a unit. I don't know.
Well, it's different because I was living, I had a really solid home life, which I don't usually have when I'm shooting. Usually
yeah.
I'm away somewhere, and then it's kind of living with, away from the family. But on this one, I went home at 6 and could have dinner with my kid and my missus and stuff. So it was, that was much more stable than usual, and it felt really good, because usually I'd be stuck into kind of going out to the pub and being away, you know.
Yeah.
But it was, I really enjoyed it. But yeah, but then the other end of it was that a lot of, what I found was interesting, having lived in Brighton for like 20 years, was having a load of people who'd never been there before turn up in the town and then find all the really good restaurants, which I didn't know anything about.
It's hard to keep on top of that stuff, isn't it? Like, I don't know.
Well, my experience of Brighton is often the train station in my house, so I don't really get
to see
much of
it. Did I read that you kind of were researching sort of real gun battles with the police and stuff before the film? I kind of find that quite fascinating, that in real life they're not, you know, these 15 second things like you often see in movies. They're these really kind of drawn out things where people don't actually fire for a very long time, and
well, or not very straight either, you know. They miss a lot, I think. Yeah, I've looked at the FBI's transcripts and stuff like that, and yeah, it did strike me that it was kind of, it's a messy business, and it's, you know, I think that the thing that's missing from a lot of the Hollywood stuff, or even in video games, it's the same thing, is that the firing at a target is one thing, but when the target fires back at you, and it basically could mean the difference between life or death, it tends to affect people massively, you know, and to the point where kind of training and stuff kind of goes out the window a little bit. So it's much more frantic than Hollywood would lead us to believe, you know.
Yeah. You mentioned video games. Do you play at all?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Counter-Strike was a big influence on this film.
Really?
Yeah, because I've been playing that since the beginning. Assault level is not dissimilar to this.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess it's kind of like, it's a necessity that it's set in the 70s, because, like, mobile phones existed, it would be all over very quickly.
Yeah, it'd be a short film, that's for sure.
Do you find that, like, I don't know, there is that limitation in a way now, where so many kind of classic film setups are kind of rendered difficult to do when you've got this kind of modern tech?
It's very difficult, because on one hand, it's not as if mobile phones have stopped all murders.
No.
It doesn't seem to have made a dent in it particularly.
Yeah.
Though I think it certainly helps the police catch people much quicker, because we're basically tracking ourselves the whole time. But yeah, I don't think modern cinema has really come to grips with the mobile phone. It's kind of so integral to everybody's lives, and so much information is passed through it in a really uncinematic way, that it, you know, it's difficult to show it on screen because it just looks rubbish. But
yeah, it's hard though, because I feel like it is inherently uncinematic, but you kind of have a duty to it in a way, don't you? If you're, you know, documenting.
Yeah.
I don't know, I maybe wonder if, you know, people at one point thought the telegram wasn't very sexy, you know.
Well, it's if you watch what's it called, Bullet. In Bullet there's a really long sequence about fax, and they send the teletype picture of the guy across, and they keep have to go back to the office, and it's going and coming out, and it's like really super high tech, and like a lot of noir movies are about high tech. So Kiss Me Deadly has quite a lot of detail about his answer phone machine, which is like this massive reel-to-reel thing, and that's kind of right in the middle of the story, is him receiving all these answer phone messages and playing them back and hearing them.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's there, but as far as I can see, the show that has the most and best use of mobile phone stuff is Ray Donovan for me.
Yeah.
That seems to be right in the middle of the show, the idea of him communicating with lots of different people really, really quickly through phone and through text and stuff.
We've seen Chef as well, that did it quite nicely.
No, I didn't see Chef, no.
Yeah. Also Better Things, I don't know if you've seen that show with Pamela Adlon.
No.
They had a really nice moment where it actually got really dramatic, where it's like, you know, someone's typing and you can see the little three dots you get or something, and then they stop, and it actually created a really kind of like choking moment. It was interesting.
So you're watching that and then you go, sad face on your phone. Sad
face. And then, so Martin Scorsese ended up executive producing.
Mm.
How did that come about, and was it?
Well, it was through, I'd met him through, while he was here doing Hugo. He did an interview for the Telegraph, I think, and they asked him what he'd been up to in the evenings, and he said he'd been watching British films. And he'd seen, like, Archipelago, the Jonah Hogg movie, and Andrew Arnold stuff. And he said he'd seen Kill List as well. So I kind of, I went, oh, wow, that's interesting. So I got my agent to contact his agent and said, can I meet up, you know? And I saw him in New York when I was doing the press stuff for Sightseers, and went to his house and met him, and it was really amazing, you know, as you imagine.
Yeah, you must have gone in, you know, with so many like preconceived notions of what he'll be like, you know.
No, I don't know, I just didn't, you just panic really, and kind of, but he's exactly how you would imagine him, you know. It's just this incredible encyclopedic knowledge of cinema, and kind of steeped in it, but also that you become kind of started to get like a kind of weird cultural feedback, realising that you just knew everybody and met everyone, and that all the stuff I knew about films is stuff I'd read, and that everything he knew about films is stuff he'd lived.
Yeah,
it's a bit weird.
Yeah, that must have been. And I loved High Rise. I think that's my favourite film of yours.
Oh,
cool.
It
was amazing. That was, I guess, the first one where you got the really kind of budget to really realise everything how you'd want it to be. And Down Terrace, your first one, right? What was the budget on that?
£6,000.
Going to what we're talking about roughly now.
£5.5 million.
So when you get these bigger budgets, do you immediately know exactly where it is in the production that you want to spend it, and you think, this is the parts that I want to improve? Is it, or does it take a little bit more thinking about than that?
I don't think you think of it in those specific terms. It's more that there's a general pot of money, and then there's the thing you've got to do, and then it starts getting doled out like dealing cards, basically. You kind of keep, so everything's kind of even, because you don't want to suddenly go, oh, we spent all the money on effects, so therefore you can't have a sound man or something like that. So it's all kind of thing, and then you start to look at it and go, well, maybe something's been, there's too much money here, we don't need that, and then you start to reassign it around where you think there's going to be a problem, or that where the person who's been doing the budget will go, well, I think it'll take you 5 days to shoot that, and as the director you kind of go, I think it's probably more 2 days, and that's fine, or you've only allowed a day for this when it's going to cost, okay, take three. So it's that kind of just very gently putting the beans out from one little pot into the next until you're committed to it.
Yeah. And like with the last couple of films, you've, you know, moved into different genres quite a lot. Is that something you want to continue? Are there other kind of genre films you want to make? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I love cinema, and there's many different types of genre that I haven't even been near yet. So I think we'll try and make a rom-com at some point, and probably make a kids film and cowboy film and
really
sci-fi film. Yeah.
Have you got like ideas in mind for a rom-com and stuff? Or?
Yeah, well, we've been trying to put stuff together for a while, but it's just taking time, you know. I think that we want to make stuff that's a bit more cheery and less murderous, but we haven't managed it yet. We want to do a film where no one dies.
Yeah, I suppose that you must feel like you want to do it after a while.
Yeah, why not?
And what have, if you're able to talk about, what have you got coming up in the immediate future?
Well, we should be making Freak Shift this year, which is the sci-fi film that Amy and I have written, which has been in development for 5-6 years now. So finally, that one looks like it's going to happen, which is about women with shotguns fighting giant crabs.
Amazing.
There you go, it sells itself, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. I read there was a talk of a TV show in the works as well. Is that still going, or is that on the back burner?
No, it's on the back burner at the moment, I think.
Yeah. Was it about Silk Road?
Yeah, it's difficult doing stuff about technology because it all moves so quick. So
yeah.
It's already.
I think everyone's having that problem at the moment, is that everyone's like trying to be like, how do we covered Trump when he moves so fast, you know. If we're looking at shooting something in 9 months, God knows what the world's going to look like then.
Yeah, well, they should just shoot quicker. That's the thing. Just do it like.
Do it.
Yeah, well, they used to do that, didn't they? You do live broadcast stuff of you know, play for today style thing. They could easily do that.
Yeah.
They'd have to write it fast, that's the only thing. But, you know, the writer's room stuff in the States pump scripts out reasonably quick, so they could do it. But I guess that's why it's only SNL that are doing the right on the nose of it, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Britain doesn't seem to be able to do that as much for some reason. America's, like, kind of nailing the whole kind of the Trump aspect, whereas the Britain's like ability to like satirise Brexit doesn't seem to be working in the same way, for whatever reason.
It's a different thing, isn't it?
Cool. Alright, well, yeah, thanks for your time today, Ben.
Okay, thank you.
Cheers.
Alright, that was episode 4. Ben was a pretty chill dude, as I'm sure you could tell. And yeah, thanks for listening. If you want to subscribe to the app, that would be great. It means the each episode is just going to come straight through to your phone rather than having to seek it out if you want to keep listening, and I hope you do. We're also on Twitter and Instagram, so get following us and tweeting us if you know if you have any thoughts. This is a new podcast. We want to know how we can make it better and more interesting for you guys. So, yeah, until next time.